arrived, she came over and handed him Conrad's car keys, plus his own money clip. Don't forget this.
Thanks. If you touched Smitty, you'll want to scrub your hands with disinfectant.
But he was such a gracious host. She fluttered a small piece of paper. He sneaked me this while you weren't looking.
What is it?
A coupon for the cover charge on my next visit.
That lousy lowlife. I should turn around and...
He broke off when Conrad opened the door of the back seat and got out.
I don't recommend Smitty's places. The dances are only so-so, and the restrooms stink worse than outhouses.
No longer drooling, reasonably clear-eyed, he was standing perfectly upright. He hadn't slurred a single word. He smiled.
Surprise!
Conrad extended his hand to Holly.
Judge Spencer, I was hoping I'd have an opportunity to meet you. I'm Conrad Hunt.
She shook his hand. Mr. Hunt,
thank you for driving my car home.
You're welcome.
I felt it best that I continue the act till we got here.
Was I convincing?
Very,
she said, laughing lightly. Beaming her a smile, he said,
come in, come in.
He placed a guiding hand beneath her elbow and directed her toward the house.
Watch your step. I would have cleared a path, but I didn't know I'd be having guests tonight.
Crawford, having recovered from his shock, planted himself in front of them.
What the hell do you think you're doing, Conrad?
I'm showing some manners, which is more than I can say for you.
Why the act? What are you trying to pull?
Conrad fanned the air in front of his face to wave away mosquitoes.
Bloodsuckers! The judge will be eaten alive if we don't get her inside.
He nudged Crawford out of his way and continued on, warning Holly again to be careful where she stepped. Bringing up the rear, Crawford muttered that Conrad had had years to clear the path to his door. The yard was still littered with junk, but he was shocked and relieved to find that the interior of the house, at least the rooms immediately visible as he went through the front door, had been tidied since his visit on Tuesday. At some point during the drive from the nightclub, Conrad had tucked in his shirt tail and smoothed down his hair, which had been standing on end when they left. He actually looked halfway presentable.
I apologize for smelling like a distillery, he was saying to Holly. The whiskey I didn't pour out under the table I've been splashing on like aftershave. Please have a seat.
He motioned her toward the sofa, over which an old but clean patchwork quilt had been spread to cover the stringy upholstery. Continuing to play host, he said,
Would you like something to drink?
No, she wouldn't.
Conrad looked over at Crawford and frowned at his rudeness.
I wasn't talking to you, and I didn't mean a drink. I was thinking along the lines of coffee or a Dr. Pepper.
Holly spoke for herself. I appreciate the offer, but no thank you, Mr. Hunt.
Call me Conrad and let me know if you change your mind.
He sat down in his recliner, popped up the footrest, and wiggled his butt around to make himself comfortable, all the while smiling at her. Then he noticed that Crawford had remained standing barely inside the front door.
Are you just going to stand there like a cigar store Indian? Why don't you sit down and try to be sociable?
I don't have time for a social call. I need to get Holly home before her guards realize she's missing.
Conrad looked at her with new interest.
You sneaked out of your house?
Something I haven't done since I was a teenager. Laughing, he slapped the arms of his recliner.
I'm glad to hear you got up to mischief. I was beginning to think you were too perfect.
Oh, no. I went through a very brief rebellious phase right after my father left, before I accepted my new role as head of the family.
How come you snuck out tonight?
Before she could reply, Crawford did.
She came to see me. We can't be seen together, so...
Why can't you be seen together? You're working the shooting case.
Not anymore.
Crawford gave him a condensed rundown of the day's events. As he finished, Conrad was shaking his head with disgust, but the first words out of his mouth were regarding Georgia.
Your little girl came through it all right?
Yeah. Thank God. She was unaware of what was going on.
didn't see me wailing into her grandpa. You want my opinion? Joe Gilroy had it coming just for being Joe Gilroy.
Crawford glanced over at Holly before saying, I'll pay for it. It might be a while before I'm allowed to see Georgia again. Conrad cursed under his breath.
I can't believe he hit you with a restraining order.
We're waiting on a date for the hearing. I'll fight it, but even if I win that battle, there's this other.
Conrad said, Neil Lester is a pompous fool with lots to prove, which makes him a dangerous pompous fool.
This wild hair he has about Crawford is ridiculous, Holly said.
A wild hair, underscored by Chuck Otterman's lie, Crawford added.
Conrad stroked his chin.
Why would Otterman lie to incriminate you?
I have no idea. Holly and I were discussing it when Smitty called to tell me that you were drunk and disorderly. What was that about? You've been drunk for real so many times. Why the play acting?
Because I didn't want anybody to guess what I was really doing there.
I'll bite, Crawford said. What were you really doing there?
Spying on Chuck Otterman.
Crawford felt like he'd been clipped behind the knees. Was Conrad the missing link to Otterman that he'd been searching for? He walked over to the sofa and sat down on the arm of it near Holly.
You were spying on Otterman.
Why?
Did you ever prosecute him?
No. At least, I don't think so.
Then what do you know about him?
Only what I've read, he waited a beat, plus what I gathered from my personal experience with him.
The surprises just keep coming. I didn't know you had any personal experience with Otterman.
Well, there's a lot you don't know.
Apparently. Tell me something I don't know, Conrad.
I applied for a job out there at the man camp.
When?
Last year, wintertime. Don't remember what month, but it was cold.
You don't know anything about that industry.
I figured I could empty trash cans. They have a maintenance and sanitation crew.
And you have a law degree, Crawford snapped. Or did.
Conrad grimaced and looked at Holly with embarrassment.
Last winter was a low point, even for me. I was out of work for months. The electric company cut me off. I needed money to get my heat back on.
Shame unspooled inside Crawford. He hated that she was hearing this, but at least now he no longer had to dread her learning just how polluted his gene pool was. Did you get the job? She asked.
Didn't want it. While I was in the office, filling out the application form, a truck came roaring up with an injured man inside, and by injured, I mean bad. His arm had been mangled by a piece of machinery. It was hanging on by a thread, literally. He was in shock. Seemed to take forever for the ambulance to get there. Meanwhile, Otterman went on a rampage, yelling at everybody. He ordered some men to get the truck cleaned out. Blood was sloshing in the floorboard, and that's no exaggeration. He told two other men to get back out to the rig where the accident had taken place and to fix whatever had malfunctioned before OSHA came calling. They were also told to pass out cash bonuses to the crewman who had witnessed the accident.
Crawford said, he bribed them to go deaf, dumb, and blind when the federal inspectors arrived.
Exactly. During all this ranting and raving, he didn't show an iota of concern for the man who was in danger of bleeding out. That changed when the EMTs arrived. It was like somebody had tripped a switch inside him. He put on quite a show. Saint Chuck, benevolent and caring, all but laid on hands and prayed over the guy he'd taken no notice of up till then.
Conrad made a face.
Sickened me. Broke as I was and needing that job, I tore up the form, left, and never went back. I'd rather be a career drunk than work for a man that two-sided. If I was still a prosecutor, I'd be on him like white on rice.
Looking for what?
Don't know,
he replied to Crawford.
But I think Mr. Chuck Otterman must have a moonlighting business.
What makes you think so?
When he's in these clubs.
Which clubs?
Like Smitty's places.
You've seen him here before tonight?
Lots of times.
Conrad looked over at Holly and gave her a pathetic smile.
I've been known to patronize some of the seedier establishments around, but I've turned over a new leaf.
She smiled at him. You're sober now?
64 days.
Excellent start. Congratulations.
I'm also gainfully employed.
Where?
At the sawmill.
During their chummy exchange, Crawford had left his perch on the arm of the sofa and made a circuit of the living room. It was straighter than he'd ever seen it. He looked through the open doorway into the kitchen. The sink was clear of dirty dishes, the counter free of coagulated spills. The floor swept. On surface, it appeared as though Conrad might truly be making an earnest stab at sobriety. But his history didn't foreshadow success. Crawford had been disappointed too many times to believe that this new leaf would be any different from many others, so he doused his flicker of optimism and brought his mind back to Ottoman. Speaking his thought aloud, he said,
"He supports local politicians and judges, but spends his evenings in strip joints."
"Where he drinks only moderately, if at all," Conrad said. "He ignores the dancing girls, but he's never idle. He holds meetings like the ones he held today."
Crawford had already heard this from Smitty.
"Who'd he meet with today?"
"It was a freaking parade," Conrad said. "And like anybody at a parade, I took pictures."
He reached into his pants pocket and withdrew a cell phone, which surprised Crawford since Conrad had never owned one.
"Where'd you get that?"
"Winn-Dixie."
"When?"
"Yesterday."
"Why?"
Conrad looked at him with annoyance.
"You want to see these or not?"
Crawford took the phone from him and accessed the photos gallery.
"Why are you just now getting around to telling me that you have pictures of Ottoman?"
"I was pacing myself. Besides, you kept interrupting."
As Crawford punched through the photos in the file, Conrad continued to talk.
"See the two guys sitting at the table nearest the booth? Bodyguards. I nicknamed them Frick and Frack. The shorter of them being Frick, but they're no nonsense. Armed. I saw the bulges. They came in with Ottoman, left with him, were very attentive the whole time he was there, didn't drink, weren't distracted by the show."
"Why would he need bodyguards?" Holly asked.
"Good question," Crawford said.
An even better question was why Smitty hadn't mentioned Ottoman being there today, knowing that Crawford would have paid him for that information. He would take that up with the slimy bastard later. Right now, Conrad had his attention.
"Men came and went," he was saying. "Ottoman talked to each separately, and their conversations ranged in length."
"Did anything change hands?" Crawford asked.
"Not that I saw, and I was looking for things like envelopes of cash. Maybe the clubs are only used as a place to negotiate terms, and the transfers take place somewhere else."
Conrad could be right. Also, Crawford had done enough computer-age detective work to know that bank account passwords were as good as, often better than, legal tender.
"Okay, go on."
"That's basically it," Conrad said. "He left with Frick and Frack. I put on my one-man show."
"Why didn't you just leave?"
"I was supposed to be drunk on my ass, remember? I was afraid if I tried to drive, they'd call the cops, who would either have thrown me in jail without administering a blood test, in which case I'd be stuck there, my phone confiscated, or they'd have drawn blood, realized I was faking, and then what? Where would you be?"
He grinned.
"Told you I was a good snoop. You can thank me later."
The images taken by the cell phone camera were grainy because of the dim lighting inside the club. Conrad had fiddled with the zoom periodically, causing some of the photos to be out of focus, and there were a couple of close-ups of his thumb. But Crawford had to give the old man credit for his ingenuity. In several of the shots, he'd caught Ottoman doing his trick with the coin. He recalled how Conrad had described him, two-sided. He hadn't realized that he'd spoken the thought under his breath until Conrad called him on it.
"Come again?"
"That thing he does with the coin."
"He was doing that on the occasion I met him," Holly said and imitated the motion.
"He's two-sided. Can change personalities in an instant. Two sides of a coin." Is there a parallel? An inside joke he's playing on everyone?
Crawford shrugged over his own conjecture. Then, looking back at Conrad, he asked,
No one noticed you photographing him?
With all those bouncing tits?
He looked over at Holly.
Girls? To look at? No one was paying any attention to a hopeless drunk getting progressively plastered, which...
He placed his hand over his heart, saying to Holly,
I regret to say I have a reputation for doing.
The old man's ability to charm her rankled, so Crawford focused on his task. Tapping on the next photograph, it immediately gave him pause. The man facing Ottoman across the table was wearing a cowboy hat. The brim cast a shadow over his face, so nothing much was showing underneath it except for his hair. The way it was pressed flat against... Hastily he applied his fingers to the screen to enlarge the picture, so he could see the man's features better. And when he got a good look, he recognized him instantly.
Holy shit.
He took in every detail, making certain that he was right before holding the phone down to where Holly could see it.
Look familiar?
Without hesitation, she whispered, That's the gunman in the courtroom.
You're sure?
100%. I wouldn't know his face because of the mask, but the hair is exactly the same.
That's what I noticed first. But we gotta be sure.
I am.
He's a cop.
She gave Crawford a swift glance, then looked again at the cell phone screen. Yes, I've seen him in the courthouse. Never wearing a hat, though. I don't know his name.
I do.
Chapter 24
Crawford headed for the door. Holly shot to her feet and went after him.
Where are you going? To make some calls. Stay put. I'll be right back.
She watched him through the screen door as he leaped over the steps of the porch and landed in the yard, his cell phone already in hand.
He's always been like that, Conrad said from his recliner. Agile and quick as a whip, even as a baby. Took after his mother that way. She was a dancer, you know.
A dancer? Holly looked back at him from over her shoulder. No, I didn't know that.
She had a studio out at the strip mall. Taught ballet and tap dancing. Jazz. All of it. Each spring she put on this big recital at the Civic Center. Everybody in town went. Quite a show. Took months for ladies to sew all the spangles on the costumes.
Holly remembered the ballet slippers in George's bedroom and wondered if that was a deliberate or subconscious link Crawford had formed between his daughter and mother. Conrad was staring into space, sadness weighing down his facial features.
She was beautiful and talented, and I guess that made her feel entitled to better, to more. She talked a lot about being unfulfilled.
Then he stirred, gathered himself, and gestured toward the yard where Crawford was pacing, his cell phone to his ear.
His mother and I were sorry excuses for parents. He turned out better than anybody had a right to expect.
Better than he gives himself credit for, Holly said, speaking more to herself than to Conrad.
You come to know him well, after only 3 days.
Seems longer.
When did you sleep together?
She whirled around and looked at him with astonishment. He chuckled over her guilty reaction.
Thought so.
Mr. Hunt, Conrad. He raised a hand to stop her.
No explanation necessary, but I'm guessing that the timing of it was problematic.
At her pained expression, he said,
Admit nothing, Judge. I don't need to know. Don't want to know. I just hope it works out okay, because, as women go, he's had it rough. His mother ran off. His wife died.
He paused, his gaze narrowing a fraction.
He loves that little girl of his. Be a damn shame if he lost her, too.
It won't be up to me. I recused myself.
Under the circumstances, that was the ethical thing to do. But forgive me for saying, you don't look too happy about it.
I feel an obligation to people who've put their trust in me and my career. I don't want to let them down.
Studying her, he frowned thoughtfully. This thing between you and Crawford, has it made you or would it make you an inferior judge? Would you be less good on the bench because of it?
No. In fact, I'd be better. He's made me realize and accept that gray areas do exist. I used to see only black and white.
Go with that, Holly, and stop beating yourself up. I happen to be an expert on disappointing people, and I can tell you from experience that the more you worry about doing it, the more you do it. Fear of failing someone becomes self-fulfilling.
I'll take that under advisement. They exchanged a smile. Then he looked through the door at Crawford.
I'd like to see him happy.
I saw him with Georgia for the first time today. While he was with her, he was happy, lit up from the inside. And why wouldn't he be? She's adorable.
Is she?
In his roomy eyes, a flicker of joy was almost instantly replaced by sorrow.
He won't let me see her.
It was plain to Holly how deeply that rejection affected him. Perhaps he'll change his mind.
No. No, I don't blame him a bit. I don't want my granddaughter to know me like this.
He raised his hands to encompass himself and his environment.
An old alky, fighting with every breath to stay sober? No. I don't want Georgia to have that image of me any more than he wants to expose her to such. No. If ever a day comes when he wants to acquaint her with her Grandpa Conrad, I'd like him to show her a picture of me from 30 years ago, when I was feared by some of the meanest sons of bitches in this state, when I was the bane of the best defense lawyers and had the utmost respect of judges. He said, adding a wink, I'd like him to tell her about how I was before, well, before.
His smile was wistful.
I'd be proud for my grandchild to know me in that light.
Crawford looked back through the screen door and wondered what Holly and his old man were talking about with such absorption. Annoyed because he'd called the same number 3 times without success, he paced a tight circle as he redialed it once again.
Come on, come on, jerk off, I know you're there.
This time the phone was answered with a timorous hello.
Nugent?
Stop calling me. I can't talk to you.
Where's Neil? I've tried every number several times.
He checked out to go to dinner with his family.
I don't care how you manage it, just find him. Tell him he needs to get an arrest warrant for Pat Connor, Joseph Patrick Connor. He's on the list of PD officers who were on duty and inside the courthouse at the time of the shooting.
I know. He was questioned and released.
Erroneously.
Text me Connor's street address. Also, tell Neil to get a search warrant for his home, car, everything. Are you getting all this? Write it down if you need to. Tell Neil to meet me at Connor's house with those warrants. I'll go on ahead, make sure he's there, and keep an eye on him till Neil arrives. And, this is very important, notify the sheriff's office that somebody needs to go out to the man camp and bring Chuck Otterman in for questioning.
You're kidding, right?
Crawford shouted.
Do I sound like I'm kidding?
Neil's already on the brink of firing me. If I tell him this came from you,
he's not going to fire you. You're a county commissioner's nephew. Don't forget to text me that address. I need it now. And if you screw this up, Neil will be the least of your worries because I'll throttle you myself. Get your butt in gear. Time to man up, Nugent.
Crawford disconnected, accessed Conrad's phone, and hastily emailed himself the photo of Pat Connor in conversation with Otterman. He strode toward the porch, hurtled the steps, pulled open the screen door, and with an underhand throw tossed Conrad his cell phone.
Guess I owe you a thanks.
Guess you do.
It was a damn crazy thing you did. Risky. But it gave me the break in the case I needed. Thanks.
I'm glad I could do something for you.
Father and son held each other's gaze for several beats. Then Crawford reached for Holly's hand. Let's go.
With her in tow, he walked hurriedly to his SUV. As he steered it down the potholed drive toward the main road, he told her that he had put things into motion.
We'll have Connor in custody within the hour. I predict he'll give up Otterman as leverage for a life sentence because he faces the death penalty if convicted of killing Chet.
You still believe Otterman was behind it?
Someone was.
Pat Connor doesn't have the imagination or initiative to pull off something like Monday's attack. Assuming it's Otterman, How did he get Connor to agree to do it?
Otterman's got to be holding something bad over Pat's head. He knows where the body's buried, a gambling debt, something. We need to find out what it is, so we'll have our own bargaining chip.
With that in mind, he reached for his phone and called Harry Longbow. Crawford told him that he had identified the courthouse shooter and gave him Connor's full name.
Prentice PD officer, a long-timer with low rank, not even a beat cop anymore. He provides security at the courthouse. Damn. I just remembered. He was one of the cops guarding Holly at the press conference the other day. Neil told me that all those officers had been cleared.
Another confidence booster, Harry drawled. What's this Connor's beef with you?
I don't think he has one, or with Judge Spencer. He's somebody's puppet.
Otterman?
Top of my list. They had a one-on-one this afternoon in a strip joint.
Crawford described the meeting.
I have the photo, which proves an alliance of some sort. I'm guessing it's unholy.
You want me to research that?
Hate to dump it in your lap, Harry.
You've got your hands full. Session is still working it, too. Hasn't come up for air in hours.
Thanks. Start with recent deposits to Pat Connor's bank account that don't look like cop pay. The mother load would be if you could trace funds of unknown origin to Otterman.
I'm getting hard already.
Rein it in. I doubt it'll be that easy.
Me too. But, you know, we can hope. Anything else?
Yeah. How was breakfast?
It took Harry a moment to piece it together, then he sighed. She told you.
Call me the second you have something.
Crawford disconnected and glanced over at Holly.
What did you and Conrad talk about?
How much he cares for you.
He made a scoffing sound. That's a laugh.
He didn't profess it in so many words, but the message came through loud and clear.
Funny, I never got that message.
Maybe you weren't listening. He shot her an angry look.
And maybe he saw a gullible audience for his sob stories. Did he tell you he wasn't invited to my wedding?
No.
Huh, that's one of his favorites. Beth urged me to include him. I refused. I told her that if he was sent an invitation, the groom would be a no-show.
Seeing the reproach in Holly's expression, he said sourly,
Before you go tearing up for poor Conrad, you should know why I was so dead set against having him as a wedding guest. See, over my objections, my aunt asked him to go with her to my high school graduation. He came, but he didn't see me walk across the staging at my diploma. Before they got to the H's, he puked his guts up in the aisle of the auditorium. He was ejected by men he was cursing at the top of his lungs and trying to fight off. He created the biggest spectacle in commencement history, and that dubious record still stands.
I'm sorry, Crawford.
Doesn't matter.
His flippancy only underscored that it did matter, a lot. She probably picked up on that. Feeling defensive, he said,
I'm telling you this crap for just one reason, and that's so you won't be taken in by Conrad's charm. Believe me, it never lasts long.
Since leaving Conrad's house, he'd had the mag mount on the roof of his SUV and lights flashing behind the grill. But once he left the highway and neared her neighborhood, he turned them off.
No one needs to know where you've been tonight. Can you sneak back in?
I sneaked out. Dropped me on the street to the south of the main house. Taking the last corner with his headlights off, he rolled to a stop at the side of the narrow lane. Through the trees, he could barely make out the roofline of her cottage. He disliked the darkness and all the good hiding places in the surrounding shrubbery.
I should see you in. Check your house.
There's no need. There never was. I wasn't the one in danger.
We could be wrong.
I don't think so.
Neither do I. But I won't breathe easy until Pat Connor and Otterman are in custody.
She placed her hand on his arm and squeezed it gently. Be careful.
I always am.
You never are. She said it with a teasing lilt, but he remained unsmiling as he removed his arm from her hand.
Save that for the hearing. You can swear to it under oath.
Crawford.
I gotta go.
Would you rather have been arrested in front of Georgia?
Now is not the time to talk about this.
Then why'd you make that snide remark?
Why'd you make that deal with Joe?
Because he gave me two options, and both were crummy. I had to make a snap decision and act on it.
You, of all people, she said, jabbing the air between them with her index finger, should relate to that.
Giving him no time to respond, she shoved open the passenger door, dropped to the ground, then slammed the door closed. She jogged toward the azalea hedge and disappeared into the foliage.
Damn it. He wanted to go after her, finish the fight, then get her naked, and watch her boil over for a different reason entirely.
Swearing, he put the SUV into reverse and backed all the way to the corner. Holly's cell phone rang just as she was unobtrusively letting herself in through the back door. She halfway expected it to be Crawford, calling to apologize or to continue their argument. But the number in her LED wasn't his.
Hello? Judge Spencer?
Greg Sanders.
The very sound of his voice made her shiver. How did you get my cell number?
I have resources.
Your client base?
Ignoring the droll remark, he said, a lot's happened since our conversation at the elevator the other day.
You've had a harrowing week.
Did you get my roses?
A thank you note is in the mail.
You liked them then?
They were thorny. He snorted a laugh. She wanted to hang up on him, but she wondered what was behind the unprecedented call.
We've exhausted the topic of roses.
You want to know why I called?
She didn't reply. He went on.
I was summoned to lockup tonight to confer with a client. The place was hopping. Guess what the rumor mill is churning out tonight?
I'm sure you can't wait to enlighten me.
Ranger Crawford Hunt, whose praises you sang the other day on TV, has been booted, pun intended.
Clever.
Off Neil Lester's investigation. Furthermore, Lester was overheard suggesting that the next time he and Hunt talk, Hunt will probably want to have a lawyer present.
I hope you're not calling me to ask for a reference. He laughed and she envisioned the large teeth and Mrs. Briggs' grandpa's mule.
No, representing Hunt might be considered a conflict of interest since you're so solidly in his corner and I'm your opponent.
I'm still failing to see the purpose of this call.
Only to say what a shame it is that you've publicly defended the guy who's suspected of planning the shooting spree.
Remember, I told you it was only a matter of time before you messed up.
And did you ever?
Surely you're not calling to gloat over an incident that caused the deaths of two men.
Even you wouldn't be that obnoxious.
No.
What happened to Chet and that other fellow is a tragedy. But in light of recent developments, your exaltation of Crawford Hunt doesn't speak well of your discernment, does it?
She had to bite her tongue to keep from revealing what she knew now about Pat Connor and Chuck Otterman.
I can't comment on an ongoing police investigation.
He guffawed. How long are you going to hide behind those skirts? Fact is, you put all your eggs in the wrong basket.
Good night.
Hold on. This turn of events has created an embarrassing situation for you. But there's an easy way out.
I don't need a way out of anything.
Nice try, but we both know better.
Why don't you fade gracefully into the background and let me run uncontested?
See? Win-win. I get what I should have had in the first place, and you get to save face.
Don't call me again.
This is a one-time offer. You should accept it.
Or what?
Or I'm going to shred you. I'm going to find out what our tough Texas Ranger was doing up in your chambers last night.
Yes, Judge, there's scuttlebutt over that, too. By the time I'm done, you'll wish you'd never heard of Judge Waters. You'll be a speck in the history books of this county's courts.
He paused, took a breath. Then, in a patronizing tone, he said,
I'd rather it not come to that. And I'm sure you don't either.
So what do you say?
She didn't say anything. Effectively thumbing her nose at him, she clicked off. Tomorrow, after Pat Connor was in custody and Crawford had been cleared of all suspicion, she would be vindicated. But that was tomorrow. First, she must endure what she anticipated would be a long night. As Crawford sped toward the address, which, surprisingly, Nugent had texted him, he left his SUV's emergency lights off, not wanting to announce his approach. Pat Connor had to be on edge, fearing that he would be found out. A nervous perp, seeing a cop and realizing the jig was up, could get trigger happy. This was one time Crawford would wait for backup. But his caution was unnecessary, because when he turned the corner onto Connor Street, it was alive with activity and ablaze with the flashing lights of half a dozen vehicles. Neighbors, most dressed in nightclothes, were standing in their yards, talking among themselves, watching with curiosity as uniformed officers strung crime scene tape around the unkempt yard. Oh, shit. Chapter 25. Crawford's purposeful stride quickly covered the distance to the open front door of a modest house where a patrolman had been posted to keep out anyone who didn't belong. He eyed Crawford warily and addressed him by name. Crawford said, "Connor."
"Found dead on his kitchen floor."
Crawford expelled a long breath and spat out an obscenity, but as he made to enter the house, the policeman took a sidestep and blocked him.
"Lester ordered me to keep everybody out."
"I'm working with Lester."
"Crawford, the word going around is that you're implicated."
"The word going around has changed."
"Since when?"
"Since the courtroom shooter turned up dead on his kitchen floor."
"Pat Connor was the courtroom shooter?"
In answer, Crawford merely raised his eyebrows. The patrolman looked around to see who might be watching, then said under his breath,
"I never saw you."
"Thanks."
Crawford stepped across the threshold directly into a forlorn-looking living room. He noticed the gun belt lying on the coffee table, the service weapon still holstered. He registered the sagging curtains, the vintage easy chair positioned directly in front of the wall-mounted flat-screen TV, a side table cluttered with the detritus of a lonely life. Noticeably missing were family photographs, books, plants, or signs of a pet. Connor was dead, but by all appearances, he hadn't been living much of a life. Without Georgia in his, this might be a crystal ball view of his future. Made uneasy by that thought, he walked from the living room into the kitchen, where Neil was bent over the corpse and talking with Dr. Anderson, who, despite his obesity, had managed to squat. Nugent was standing in the doorframe of an open pantry, looking distinctly ill at ease. When Crawford walked in, he gave a twitch and said,
Neil?
Upon seeing Crawford, Neil stood up slowly.
"How'd you get in here?"
"Walked."
Neil let the smart-aleck remark pass.
"I got your messages. As it turns out, the warrants for Connor that you requested won't be necessary."
"You discovered him?"
"As you see him."
He stood aside. Connor's body had crumpled, folding in on itself, his face to the floor. He'd been shot in the back of the head. Neil said,
"Two bullets, close range. Somebody wanted him not just dead, but very dead."
Crawford took in the rest of the scene. An open can of Coke stood on the counter with a partially filled drinking glass beside it. A bottle of whiskey was on the floor near the body, tipped over onto its side. Particularly gruesome was the confluence of spilled liquor and blood on the grimy vinyl floor.
"Looks like he was pouring himself a drink and was unaware of his visitor," Neil said.
"Either that, or he had enough trust to turn his back on him." Crawford addressed the ME.
"How long's he been dead?"
"Best guess, a couple of hours."
He reached for Crawford's hand. Crawford helped haul him up. He puffed a thanks.
"I'll notify you as soon as I can be more precise on the timing." "That his phone?"
Crawford indicated the cell phone Neil was holding in his gloved hand.
"One of them?"
"He had more than one?"
"The one with his official number was on the end table in the living room. It's already been bagged. I found this one in his pants pocket."
He activated the phone, accessed a page, and held it up for Crawford to see the screen.
"The video of Georgia.
Sent by text to your cell phone at..."
"I know what time I got it, Neil,"
Crawford said tightly.
"I was there."
Sensing the tension between the two, the ME said,
"Excuse me. I'll go check on the ambulance. Let me know when I can have him."
Following his departure, the other three were left in an awkward, almost hostile silence. Crawford was the first to speak.
"Have you searched the house?"
"I have uniforms doing that," Neil replied. "Nugent made a walkthrough as soon as we got here."
Nugent said,
"I didn't find anything out of the ordinary."
"I wouldn't expect you to," Crawford said.
He left behind the evidence of the courtroom shooting. We'll be able to match his DNA to what we got off the painter's overalls and mask.
What makes you think he was the courtroom shooter? Neil asked. You failed to elaborate when you called Nugent and threatened him to get his button gear or else.
Crawford used his phone to open the email he'd sent to himself and showed Neil the picture of Pat Connor with Otterman.
This was taken earlier this evening. I instantly recognized Pat as the shooter.
He was one of the officers guarding the judge during the press conference.
A short while ago, I remembered that.
You didn't have an epiphany then?
He wasn't wearing a hat.
And the hat made all the difference to you?
You're scoffing, but actually it did.
To Holly, too, but he couldn't tell Neil that. Neil continued,
It was Pat Connor who told me about your meeting in chambers last night with Judge Spencer. He saw you leave, hot under the collar.
Crawford remembered that a cop had been lurking in the darkened corridor as he'd left Holly's office.
Was he by any chance my tail taking the pictures?
No.
Then what was he doing up there at that hour?
More to the point, what were you?
He didn't answer that.
It should tell you something that since Monday, Pat Connor had placed himself in our paths, mine and the judge's, when I hadn't bumped into him more than a handful of times in the past 5 years. He was keeping tabs on us. He was the shooter, Neil. Same hair, body type. Check his left knee. He's probably still got the bruise.
I've already told Dr. Anderson to look for that. But even if Connor was our shooter, why'd he do it?
Somebody put him up to it.
I agree. Who?
Best guess?
Crawford tapped the screen of his phone to pull up the picture again.
He was with Otterman early this evening in a club called Tickled Pink.
How'd you get the picture?
That's your question? You're standing 3 inches from a dead cop who had a covert conversation today with a man who by his own admission left a crime scene, and that's your question?
Neil remained unflappable.
True to form. You're making a coincidence into a crisis just so you can spring into action and dazzle us all.
Fine. You don't want to soil your hands with something potentially messy like a corrupt cop schmoozing with a bigwig. Give it over to me. Because I don't give a shit who I offend. I want the bastard behind Chet's death. And I think it's the same smug bastard who lied about me and Rodriguez. Soon as Otterman gets to headquarters, put me in an interrogation room with him. I'll wring his thick neck till he...
He's out of town.
What?
He's gone fishing for the weekend. His secretary doesn't know where. She thinks somewhere in Louisiana. He'll be back on Monday. I asked her to have him call me if he reported in, but she doesn't expect him to.
Disbelieving what he was hearing, Crawford looked over at Nugent, who gave an abashed shrug. When Crawford went back to Neil, he regarded him with genuine perplexity.
You're content to sit back and wait until Monday?
Oh, not at all. I'll be busy turning your life inside out. I did obtain a search warrant, but it's for your house. Consider it served.
He removed the document from his pocket and shoved it at Crawford. Looking down at the corpse, he continued,
Connor sent you a video of your daughter. Was that intended as a wake-up call? A subtle threat? I don't know. But, knowing how you feel about her, it's definitely a motive. Can you account for your time this evening?
He could, but not without involving Conrad and Holly. Instead, he tried to reach Neil in a way that Neil would respond to.
You're making a ruinous career choice here, Neil. Think it over very carefully before you decide to proceed.
I've already decided.
You're arresting me?
Not yet. I'm asking you to come down to headquarters for questioning.
This time I'll have a lawyer with me.
Good idea. Turn around.
Understanding his intention, Crawford turned and raised his hands in the air. Neil pulled his pistol from the holster at the small of his back.
One sniff, you'll know it hasn't been recently fired.
You wouldn't be that stupid. I know it's not the murder weapon.
You're just being careful.
That's right.
Can I drive myself to the courthouse?
Sure,
Neil said. Then to Nugent.
Go with him. Soon as CSU gets here, I'll be along.
Crawford gave the grisly sight on the floor one last glance, then left through the living room, Nugent on his heels. The patrolman at the front door said,
Everything okay?
Crawford didn't bother answering. Once in his SUV, Nugent riding shotgun, Crawford called William Moore.
Did I wake you up?
It's okay, the attorney replied with customary terseness. I'll charge you my after-hours rate.
Can you meet me at police headquarters in 15 minutes?
What happened?
Apprentice cop took two bullets in the back of his head. That's all I'll say now. I'm not alone.
You're under arrest?
Not quite. Can you be there?
I'm not a criminal lawyer, Crawford, and that's what you need. I recommend Ben Knotts.
That guy, hell no, I've seen him in action. I brought a case to trial and Knotts defended the sleazebag who popped his girlfriend for horning in on his dogfighting operation.
Was the sleazebag acquitted?
Crawford sighed and said grudgingly, Have Ben Knotts call me ASAP.
He disconnected. Nugent, who hadn't spoken up till then, said, I probably shouldn't be telling you. I mean, I guess it should come from Neil.
What?
Somebody ID'd Rodriguez this afternoon. At a sharp look from Crawford, he rushed on. Guy who owns a landscaping company in Lufkin had to fire him a few weeks ago on account of, well, lots of DMV red tape after Rodriguez got a routine traffic ticket. That's when they discovered Rodriguez's documents were fake. Landscaper liked him, hated to let him go because he'd worked for him for several years. Dependable, all that. But he has a policy against hiring undocumented.
Why is he just now coming forward?
He's been on vacation in Colorado, got back last night. Caught up on local news this morning. He emailed us a copy of the phony green card. Name on it is Jorge Rodriguez. Still not sure that was his real name. The picture, though, it's him.
Did he have a family?
He lived with a woman, two kids. Landscape guy doesn't know if they were married, but probably not. He's going to pay for his burial, said it was a shame.
It was a fucking shame that filled Crawford with incredible sadness. I appreciate you telling me, Matt. Thanks.
Nugent tore at a loose cuticle with his teeth. Why would you call about Connor, tell Neil to meet you at his house, if you knew what he'd find when he got there?
Doesn't make sense, does it?
Unless it's true what they say.
Who's they?
Everybody.
What do they say?
That he's not seeing straight. Crawford declined to comment as he pulled into a parking space at the courthouse. His phone jangled.
Must be the lawyer.
He answered and told the caller to hold on, then said to Nugent,
Can you give me a minute?
I'll be right over there, and I better take your key. Crawford pulled it from the ignition and handed it to Nugent, who got out and went to huddle beneath a shallow overhang above the building's side entrance. It had started to drizzle. Crawford answered his phone.
Crawford Hunt.
How does it feel?
Excuse me?
Your world has come crashing down around you, hasn't it? The hushed voice was full of menace, and Crawford recognized it immediately.
You son of a bitch.
The laugh that filled his ear was nasty with delight.
So many bad things happening to you, and guess what? There's even worse on the way.
The caller disconnected. Crawford quickly checked the call log, but, as expected, it said only unknown where a name and number should have been. He sat there wavering between rage and fear. From the day of the custody hearing, there had been a purposefully orchestrated dismantling of his life. Being suspected of Pat Connor's murder was just the most recent catastrophe in a carefully planned, destructive sequence. There's even worse on the way. Crawford knew down to his marrow that it wasn't an empty threat. He stared through his rain-pebbled windshield at the looming structure of the courthouse. The upper floors were dark, but all the windows were alight on the ground floor where police headquarters were. He looked at Nugent, shoulders hunched against the increasing rainfall, hands in his pockets, jingling change like a man waiting for a bus. Crawford's cell phone dinged. He checked the caller ID and saw the name Ben Knotts, the recommended criminal attorney. He let the call go to voicemail. After a few more seconds of consideration, realizing what he had to do, he banged his fist hard against the ceiling of his SUV. Neil pulled his car into an empty parking space, got out, walked briskly to the side entrance reserved for police personnel, and was surprised to find Nugent loitering just outside it.
What are you doing out here? Where's Crawford?
Nugent indicated the familiar SUV parked in the second row of the lot. Talking to a lawyer, he put in a call on the way here.
That was 15 minutes ago. Nugent checked his wristwatch. Closer to 20. Neil looked at the SUV, seeing nothing in the darkly tinted windows except a watery reflection of the courthouse.
God damn it!
He struck off running toward it.
He couldn't have gone anywhere, Nugent called. I have his key.
Neil jerked open the driver's door. Lying on the seat was a cell phone, along with the bulbs that belonged in the dome light and the twin map lights on either side of the rearview mirror. Otherwise, the vehicle was empty. Chapter 26. Holly was in bed, but not asleep. She answered her phone after the first ring.
You've shown a knack for sneaking out, Crawford said, sounding out of breath. Think you can do it again? This time in your car?
What number is this?
A burner phone.
What's going on? Have you arrested Pat Connor?
That didn't go as planned. I need you to pick me up.
Where are you? Where's your truck?
Sitting empty in the courthouse parking lot. And when Neil discovers me missing from it, he'll go mental. And then he'll put out an APB, and if I'm apprehended, I go to jail. And I can't go. Not yet. Not tonight. Will you do it?
She tried to process it all as rapidly as he'd related it. Why would Neil put out an APB on you?
Connor's dead.
In clipped cop speak, he described the murder scene. Amid her murmurs of disbelief, he continued in the same rapid-fire way.
I went there to arrest him, and instead wound up in Nugent's custody. I went quietly and was willing to go through the first round of questioning. But then I got a phone call.
From whom?
I'll explain that when you get here.
She hesitated, and as though reading her mind, he said,
I wouldn't ask you to aid and abet, Holly. Timing is everything, and right now, this minute, I haven't been charged with a crime, and I'm not asking you to commit one. But I need a fair and impartial witness to something I'm about to do. Someone with unimpeachable integrity who could later testify as to my motive for doing it.
What are you going to do?
He said nothing for several seconds then. Do you think I killed Connor?
I know you didn't.
Do you think I was behind the courtroom shooting?
No.
I'm under the Jackson Street Bridge, eastbound side. 10 minutes. If you're not here by then, I'll know you aren't coming.
As he slid into her passenger seat, he said,
That was 12 minutes. I was getting worried.
He turned to look out the rear window. The wet streets were dark. No other vehicles were in sight, which was why a man on foot, walking through the rain, would have attracted attention to any cop on patrol. Besides, it would have taken him too long to cover on foot the distance he had to go. There was no time to waste. She pulled back into the traffic lane. I don't know where we're going.
Turn around when you can. We've got to get on the opposite side of downtown, but keep to the back streets. How did you manage to get away without being followed?
I drove through my backyard to the driveway over the main house. I went out that way.
You really do have a knack. The next left will put you on Fair Avenue. Go south. I'll tell you where to turn.
An hour ago, I told the police on duty at my house that I was retiring for the night. But if they notice that my car isn't parked in back, Neil will probably issue an APB for it, too.
He will. But it won't do him any good. I switched out your license plates.
She glanced at him with disbelief. What? When?
Tuesday night. Actually, Sessions did, but I asked him to.
Why?
You weren't taking the need for guards seriously. In case you shook them, I would have your new tag number. The unsub, even if he was a cop, wouldn't.
I was never in danger.
I didn't know that then. We'd only just discovered that Rodriguez wasn't the gunman. By the way, he's been identified.
He recounted everything Nugent had told him.
He was probably in the courthouse to see about getting legal documentation, got nervous about possibly being deported, went up to have a cigarette while rethinking it.
He wasn't involved.
Not until he picked up that pistol.
Crawford would forever regret that young man's fate, but for now, he had to table his sorrow over it. Other matters couldn't be postponed.
At the second caution light, go left. Stay straight for about a mile.
How did you get away from Nugent?
I disabled the interior lights and crawled out the tailgate. I feel bad about tricking him. He's a decent guy, just not good cop material.
Why does Neil persist in considering you a suspect?
You can ask him that when he questions you.
Do you think he will?
I know he will, or he should. About 3 blocks ahead, take a ride on Pecan.
What will you tell Neil?
That depends on what he asks me, but I'll have to be truthful.
You haven't done anything illegal.
No, ill-advised, perhaps, she said, shooting him a small smile.
Smitty's been put on notice. On pain of death, he won't talk about your visit to his club. Conrad won't. With luck, you'll be back to your house before it's noticed that your car's missing. If you are caught, you can say truthfully that a friend called and begged for your help, and you can't breach that friend's confidence. All of it the truth.
You make it sound so easy. As I told you the night we met, you have more experience with crisis situations than I do. I'm an amateur.
Greg Sanders urged me to cut and run before he shreds me. After she told him the highlights of their recent conversation, Crawford muttered a few choice epithets.
He's bluffing, pushing your buttons to see how you'll react.
Maybe, but apparently he has contacts within the police department who have been keeping him updated. He knew you'd been implicated in the courthouse shooting. By now he's probably heard about Connor. That will really make his day.
Jesus, Holly, I'm sorry. I wouldn't have dragged you deeper into this, but I didn't have time tonight to come up with a plan B.
You've yet to tell me about the phone call that prompted this emergency.
I'll tell you when we get there.
Where are we going?
To my father-in-law's house.
She braked hard in the middle of the street and turned to him with dismay and anger.
No wonder you're just now telling me that.
I'm only going to talk to him.
As though he'd told her he was going to beat the living daylights out of Joe Gilroy, she kept her foot on the brake and she shook her head firmly.
Whatever you have in mind, I can't be a party to it.
I'm not even armed.
Neil took my pistol. He motioned her forward.
Drive.
Absolutely not.
Fine. Thanks for the lift.
In a flash, he was out of the car and running as fast as he could in cowboy boots to cover the remaining few residential blocks. The Gilroys lived in a well-established neighborhood of older homes, situated on large lots with carefully maintained lawns and mature trees. Holly followed him in her car, but she was forced to keep to right angles while he cut diagonally across driveways and yards. When he reached the Gilroy's house, he ran alongside the side of it toward the rear. He heard the squeal of Holly's brakes, her car door being shut, her running footsteps slapping the wet pavement of the driveway. He reached the back door mere seconds ahead of her. He raised his hand to knock, but she rushed up behind him and grabbed his forearm in a two-handed grip. Her breath coming in fast pants, she said,
"Crawford, whatever you're thinking of doing, don't, I beg you, for George's sake."
The door came open suddenly.
What the bloody hell?
Joe Gilroy, standing behind the screen door, took in the situation at a glance. To Holly, he said,
I tried to tell you, didn't I?
I'm calling the police.
I am the police, Crawford said. You're a hazard.
This time you go to jail. Joe turned away. Crawford was vaguely aware of Holly losing her balance when he shook off her grasp, but through the screen he could see Joe going for the phone. And he had to stop him. He pulled on the door handle. Discovering it locked, he jerked on it repeatedly and viciously until the old-fashioned clasp gave way. Then he flung open the door and rushed inside. He was across the kitchen in 2 strides, snatching the cordless phone out of Joe's hand and throwing it to the floor. Grace appeared, her hand at her throat, crying out in alarm as the 2 men went at each other. Joe threw punches that would have leveled anyone weaker and slower to react. Crawford dodged the pounding fists and at the same time landed a few well-placed punches. Holly cried out, Crawford, stop, stop. Crawford saw that Joe was becoming winded and used that to his advantage. He drove his shoulder into the older man's midriff and pushed him backward until he came up against the counter, then planted his hand in the center of Joe's chest and lodged his knee up between his thighs. Joe was red-faced with fury. His teeth were clenched.
I'm going to kill you.
Maybe, Crawford said, breathing hard.
Later. But right now, you're going to get Georgia up like hell I am.
He tried to wrestle free from Crawford's restraining hand, but Crawford jammed his knee directly beneath Joe's testicles.
You're going to get Georgia up and dressed and leave. Take her away from here, Joe. please, he said, his voice cracking. Get her away from me. It never failed to freak Smitty out, this thing that Chuck Otterman did with the 50-cent piece. It was like he was trying to hypnotize you or something, but it had the opposite effect on Smitty. Rather than lull him, it made him nervous as a whore in church. Every time he came to this place, he dreaded it more, and always considered himself lucky when he was able to leave under his own power, drive away in his own car, all his parts still attached, his heart lub-dubbing in a more or less regular rhythm. The only reason he risked coming here was because doing business with Otterman was so profitable. But their transactions required him to drive for miles through an eerie swamp, nary a light to be seen after sundown, to this fishing cabin that had probably been put together by a coon ass using Elmer's and thumbtacks. He'd once asked Otterman what state it was in, Texas or Louisiana. Are you into geography? Not really. Then what difference does it make? The difference it made was a long list of federal crimes involving words like interstate trafficking. But Smitty kept his concerns to himself and had continued to make periodic trips to this old fishing shack way out in the middle of spooky effing nowhere. The corrugated tin roof leaked. A bucket had been placed on the floor to catch the constant drip from the hard rain that contributed to the chilling atmosphere. The plunking sound the drops made as they splashed into the bucket was driving Smitty to distraction. But Otterman seemed unbothered as he set aside his coin and counted out $100 bills onto the table between them, forming neat stacks of 50. When he had 10 stacks, he passed them one by one to Smitty, who placed them in a pouch. With a flourish, Smitty zipped it up and flashed Otterman a grin. Those boys guarantee their product. You have any trouble with the guns, you be sure to tell me. You can count on that. Otterman's tone wasn't the friendly kind that Smitty had been hoping for. Truth was, it had the undercurrent of a threat and made him need to pee. With false bravado, he said, When you need more, you know who to call. And he winked. Always a pleasure doing business with you, Mr. Otterman. He stood up. Sit down. Smitty dropped back into his seat. For what seemed like an endless time, the only sounds in the room were the incessant drips, the rain striking the metal roof like a hail of bullets, and distant rumbles of thunder. Finally, Otterman said, Pat Connor. Know that name?
I don't believe I do.
Prentice policeman.
Oh, well, no wonder.
Smitty shot a laugh over his shoulder at the two men standing behind him. I don't have many friends among enforcers of law and order. Earlier this evening, Connor met with me in your crappy nightclub.
What about?
A couple hours later, he died in his kitchen.
Ticker gave out?
He was shot dead while pouring himself a drink. Now Smitty really had to pee.
You don't say, huh? I hadn't heard that. The clubs don't close till 2 a.m., so I don't often see the evening news.
He was discovered too late to make tonight's news. Otterman glanced up at the man standing at Smitty's right shoulder. But I have it on good authority that two bullets were fired into the back of Connor's skull. Smitty whistled, or tried to. His lips were too rubbery to pucker.
That ought to do it, all right.
To have been executed like that. Connor must have let down someone who was counting on him to deliver. Money, goods, information. Something of value like that. Smitty actually flinched when Otterman suddenly sat forward and leaned toward him across the table. Do you know Crawford Hunt? He screwed up his face as though thinking hard.
Crawford Hunt. Crawford Hunt. The name sounds familiar, but I can't quite place him.
Otterman said mildly, Take your time. Think about it. After a few seconds, Smitty pretended to have suddenly remembered.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Wasn't he the guy?
The Texas Ranger.
Right, right,
he said, snapping his fingers.
Wasn't it him who was in the courtroom when it got shot up this week? Is that who you're talking about?
Otterman flipped the coin, caught it, and formed a fist around it, then leaned even closer towards Smitty. You're a pimp, a crook, and a creep. The only reason I tolerate your company
is so I don't have to personally deal with the backwoods redneck lowlifes around here who supply surprisingly good guns. But if you ever lie to me again, not only is your lucrative sideline with me finished, I'll burn your ratty clubs to the ground, and then stick the barrel of one of those pump actions up your anus and pull the trigger.
Smitty swallowed and bobbed his head in complete understanding. Ottoman sat back and calmly resumed rolling the coin across the backs of his fingers.
Let's try to have an honest conversation. I'll go first. After I left your club tonight, Crawford Hunt was seen there, in your company, Smitty. He also had a woman with him. They carried somebody out.
His old man, who's a sorry drunk. If you were from around here, you'd know the history. Anyway, tonight he was worse off than usual. I had to call Crawford to come and get him and cover his tab.
That's it.
That's it.
You have no other dealings with Crawford Hunt.
Shit, no. I hate his guts.
A few years back, he busted me for public lewdness. A guy can't get a blowjob in his own car.
Who was the woman?
Can't remember her name, but she could shrink wrap your dick.
The woman with Hunt, you idiot.
Oh, the judge.
Holly Spencer.
She doesn't look like any judge I ever faced. Firm tits, smoking ass.
Ottoman didn't react for several seconds. Then he cracked a smile that sent chills down Smitty's spine.
You're the expert on that.
He forced himself to chuckle.
Well, I reckon everybody's got to be good at something.
Otterman's smile relaxed until it was no more.
The boys will see you out.
With no more notice than that, the boys jerked him to his feet with such force his teeth clicked together. He was supported between them as they dragged him toward the door. It occurred to Smitty, in a moment of blinding, terrifying clarity, that he'd forgotten the money pouch and that this time he wasn't leaving the fishing shack under his own power. Crawford's plea to his father-in-law had left the four of them in a bizarre freeze frame. He was the first to move. He turned his head and looked at Holly. In a gruff voice, he asked, "Are you hurt?" Astounded by the sudden turnabout, she looked at him with bafflement.
"Hurt?
You lost your balance on the step."
"Oh, no, I'm okay."
Still holding her gaze, he said,
"You understand now why I wanted you here to see this, hear it?"
"I believe so."
"I still want custody of Georgia. This doesn't change that."
Turning back to his father-in-law, he said,
"We'll continue our fight, Joe. Once all this is over, we'll pick up where you threw that last punch if that's how you want it. But you've got to get Georgia away from here tonight. Right now."
He lowered his knee so that it was no longer wedged between Joe's thighs and withdrew his hand from the man's chest. Having seen for herself the ferocity of Joe Gilroy's hatred for Crawford, Holly halfway expected him to launch another physical attack. He didn't, but his facial features remained granite hard, his eyes piercing. He said,
"I'm not going anywhere until you tell me what this is about. What's happened?"
Rain had plastered Crawford's hair to his forehead, but he seemed impervious to it and his wet clothes.
"I know who the courtroom shooter was. So does Holly."
Joe's eyes cut to her.
"It's true," she said.
"I identified apprentice police officer as the gunman."
"How'd you figure it out?"
"Too long to go into," Crawford said.
"But an hour or less after we made this discovery, he turned up dead, murdered inside his house, and it wasn't pretty."
Grace made a mournful sound.
"Let's all sit down. I'll make coffee."
"There's no time for coffee, Grace,"
Crawford said.
"Start gathering up only what you'll absolutely need to take with you."
"For how long?"
"I don't know. A few days, maybe."
"Hold on, Grace,"
Joe said when it appeared that she would do as Crawford asked.
"I haven't heard anything that compels me to pack up my family and sneak out of town in the middle of the night like a band of gypsies. Can't you for once just do something without having to be the fucking commander?"
Holly took a handful of Crawford's shirt and pulled him backward, then stepped between him and his father-in-law.
"Mr. Gilroy, Mrs. Gilroy," she said, turning her head to include Grace. "We've concluded that I wasn't the intended target in the courtroom. Crawford was."
Joe glanced beyond her toward Crawford.
"Well, that doesn't surprise me,"
But why specifically?
Do you know a man named Chuck Otterman? Crawford asked.
I've heard of him.
Sure.
Runs the drilling outfit. What's he got to do with it?
As concisely as possible, Holly explained the situation. Crawford has Texas Rangers in the Houston office trying to determine what the connection is and why Otterman would conspire to have him killed. Crawford took over for her.
In the meantime, he called me.
That took Holly aback. The phone call you mentioned, it was Chuck Otterman?
I recognized his voice.
He repeated the brief conversation.
He said there was worse coming my way, and I take that threat seriously. Everything else he's done has been a sick warning. The park video, trashing George's room, and
trashing her room.
Joe, we can't explain it all now, he said impatiently. Bottom line, Neil Lester, for reasons of his own and in part thanks to you, is trying to pin all this on me. All I did was ask. I know what you asked, and it was bullshit. But Neil has run with it. I slipped away tonight, but if he finds me, he can hold me for 48 hours before charging me, and if I'm in lockup, I can't protect Georgia, and I go a little crazy when I think of Otterman getting near her, touching her. This threat you say he issued, I don't say it. He did it.
Okay, but he didn't mention Georgia.
Damn it, Joe. Are you willing to risk her life just to win an argument with me?
Don't lay any of this on me. The older man shouted back, it's a mess of your own making.
Crawford closed his eyes briefly, and when he reopened them, they were bright with an intensity of feeling.
You gotta know how hard it is for me to come here and ask you for a goddamn thing. But you must put our quarrel aside and get Georgia out of here.
The older man opened his mouth to speak, but Crawford headed him off,
and it's gotta be now.
Holly divided a look between the two adversaries, still facing off, each as unbending as the other. Taking matters into her own hands, she walked over to Grace.
If you'll show me where things are, I'll help you pack.
While Grace, Joe, and Holly hurriedly collected and packed essentials, Crawford moved from room to room, checking the street out front as well as the back of the property, watching for the stealthy approach of policemen or squad cars, because he figured Neil would eventually think to look for him here. And so might Otterman or his emissaries. At some point, Grace brought him a towel. He'd dried off as well as he could while remaining vigilant.
Daddy?
When Georgia spoke his name, he turned away from a window overlooking the street, and the sight of her caused a pinching pain in his heart. Holly had quietly gathered articles of clothing from her drawers and packed them in her suitcase, but they'd waited until the last possible moment to wake her up and get her dressed. She looked sleepy and uncertain as she gazed up at him. Mr. Bunny was clutched to her chest.
Grandma said we're going on a trip. I don't want to.
Sure you do.
Crawford picked her up and hugged her close. Her arms closed tightly around his neck, her legs around his waist.
Can I go to your house?
Not this time.
She laid her head on his shoulder and turned her face into his neck. This was tearing him apart, but he had to be the grown-up, the brave one. He infused his voice with false enthusiasm.
You're going to have a great time.
That's what Holly said.
She's right. Grandma and Grandpa have lots of fun things planned, but you have to be a good girl and mind everything they say, okay?
Why can't you come?
Because I have to work. But I'll be thinking about you the whole time and wishing I was with you.
He felt her chest hitch with a small hiccup that presaged tears. He told himself she was crying from sleepiness, from being startled awake and confronted with a situation that was out of the ordinary and beyond her understanding. But whatever the reason, he couldn't bear parting from her when she cried. Rubbing circles on her back, he murmured into her hair,
"Come on now. You're going to be all right. Let's get you into the car."
"Will you carry me?"
He squeezed his eyes shut to keep his own tears inside.
"You bet."
Holding her tightly against him, he carried her through the house, now dark, and into the attached garage, where Joe was placing her suitcase, the last of the luggage, into the trunk. When he would have walked past Crawford without saying anything, Crawford addressed him. His father-in-law stopped and looked at him.
You're the only person I trust to do this, Joe.
I know you'll protect her as fiercely as I would.
Joe held his gaze, gave a curt nod, then got into the driver's seat. Without further delay, he carried Georgia to the back seat door, which Holly was holding open for them. He settled Georgia into her seat. When she started to reach for the straps, he said,
"Let me buckle you in this time."
"Mr. Bunny, too?"
"Of course."
He clicked the fasteners and made sure they were secure, then placed his hands on either side of her face and pressed his forehead against hers.
"Be sweet for Daddy."
"Okay."
"I love you."
"More than anything?"
she asked, repeating what he often said. "More than anything."
He kissed her forehead, her hair, her cheek, and finally her lips. But when he tried to back away, she reached for him. "Daddy, where we're going, will you be there tomorrow?"
"Probably not tomorrow."
"When?"
"As soon as I can get there."
Then before he let her forlorn expression change his mind about the necessity of this separation, he kissed her again, quickly stepped back and closed the car door. She placed her hand flat against the window glass. On the outside of it, he kissed her palm, then aligned his large hand with her tiny one, and they stayed that way until Joe backed the car out.
Chapter 27.
"Where will they go?"
Holly asked, as Crawford hustled her into her car.
The street was empty. Nearby houses were dark. From all appearances, no one had noticed their brief visit with the Gilroys. Even so, Crawford was scanning the area, alert to the motion of every leaf, the spatter of every raindrop.
"Grace's sister recently remarried, after years of widowhood. She lives with her new husband in a retirement community outside Austin."
"They're in for a long drive."
5 hours, give or take. Rain may slow them down. I hope Georgia sleeps most of the way."
"I don't know how you said goodbye to her without cracking."
"I don't know how I did either."
He stared vacantly for a few seconds, then cleared his throat and indicated her ignition.
"Get going. I need to be well away from here before Neil comes looking."
"He's called me."
Steering with her left hand, she used her right to pull her cell phone from the front pocket of her jeans and passed it over to him. It had been vibrating, but I ignored it. I checked it while Grace was getting Georgia dressed, but I didn't listen to the messages.
"He's left two," he said. "And you have one text, but it's from Marilyn."
"Why would she be texting me?"
"Want me to read it?"
"Please."
He pulled it up.
"It says, 'WTF is going on.' Wording doesn't sound like she's trying to mend fences."
"Call her for me, please."
He used the phone to make the call, but it went through the Bluetooth speaker of the car. As soon as Marilyn answered, she blared,
"Holly, thank God you called. I've been worried sick."
"Why?"
"That detective called, the tight ass, Lester. Anyway, he was at your house and..."
"At my house? When was this?"
"One vodka and 3 cigarettes ago. He asked if I'd heard from you, and I told him no, that you were no longer my client. Then he told me that you were missing and feared that you'd met with foul play. That's how he put it. He mentioned the murder of a police officer. I've been going crazy here. Where are you? Are you all right?"
"Yes, I'm fine."
"You're not being made to say that under duress, are you?"
"No. However, I can't talk now. There's a situation that I really need to attend to. I apologize for the scare and appreciate your concern, truly."
She was about to disconnect using the button on her steering wheel when Marilyn said,
"The situation involves him, doesn't it? And don't you dare insult me by asking who. The shooting was only the first shock to your system, wasn't it? Mr. Tall, Blonde, and Badass was another."
During the course of their conversation, Holly had been keeping her eyes on the road. Now she flicked a gaze over to Crawford, who was sitting as still as a stone beside her, his eyes fixed on her, taking in every word.
"Your silence is screaming at me, Holly," Marilyn continued. "And what I'm hearing is conflict of interest, circumspection versus lust, a moral and ethical dilemma in spades, all of which are right up my alley," she chortled. "I can't wait to tackle them."
"I fired you, remember?"
"Yes, but now I get why. You were protecting him."
"From you?"
"Right, but I can back off that."
Listen, Marilyn.
No, you listen. You're an excellent judge, Holly. Dedicated and idealistic. You actually believe in what you're doing. And that's not just me trying to woo you back. I happen to mean it. You should be in that job.
After this week, I'm afraid Governor Hutchins will rethink his endorsement. Greg Sanders has suggested that I make a graceful exit to save face.
No way in hell. The governor's blessing is a stroke we can always use, but I can get you elected without it. Hell, I might even do something totally revolutionary in politics and awe the voting public with the truth. Sometimes that's actually the best approach. Hide in plain sight. I'll be thinking about our strategy. In the meantime, tend to this situation with the Texas Ranger. He's a rude bastard, but he definitely has appeal. When you need me, I'll be ready.
After the disconnect, she couldn't avoid Crawford's grin.
You called me tall, blonde, and badass?
I didn't. Marilyn did.
Will you hire her back?
I don't know. More importantly, did you hear the part about Neil being at my house?
Yeah.
His grin faded as he sighed.
I should have left you out of this, but I couldn't rely on Grace to back me up. Joe could have browbeat her into claiming that I had relinquished Georgia to them without any stipulation that it was temporary. I needed you there, but I hate further involving you in what Joe correctly called a mess of my making.
Although, hell if I know what I did to piss off Otterman, a man I'd never even seen before he walked into the police station.
He leaned his head back and closed his eyes. Looking at his profile, she was struck by how utterly fatigued he appeared. There were dark crescents under his eyes. The hollows beneath his cheekbones were more pronounced than usual. She asked, "When did you sleep last?"
"I don't remember."
"You're exhausted."
"Joe's no pushover, and I've fought him twice today. Then the episode with my old man. None of my run-ins with him are easy. But what really took it out of me was having to tell Georgia goodbye."
"Which you've also done twice today."
"Both times wrenching. Tonight was different, though. She sensed something was wrong. I goddamn hate that she's worried. I couldn't promise her when I would see her again. And the fact is..."
"The fact is?"
"If Otterman has his way, I never will."
Suddenly he sat up straight and opened his eyes, the darkened sockets making them look extraordinarily bright with resolve. Thumping his fist on his thigh in time to his words, he said,
"I can't let that happen. I may not regain custody of her, but I'll go to hell and back before checking out on her."
"What are you going to do?"
"Stay alive. Stay underground long enough to get Otterman before he gets me."
"How do you intend to go about that?"
"That's the tricky part. I'm working on it."
"You could turn yourself in to Neil, enlist his help."
"No way. He's bowed his back on Otterman."
"Maybe he's changed his mind."
"I can't chance it. I'd be hamstringing myself."
"There's nothing I can say that will change your mind?"
"Sorry, Holly. No."
She pulled the car over to the side of the road and turned to face him. "Then you need to get out." Crawford watched Holly's taillights disappear, then struck off walking swiftly, hoping to blend into the darkness and keep from being seen. First order of business was to find shelter from the rain. He covered a couple of blocks before coming upon a vacant house with a for sale sign in the yard. Crouching against the back wall of the open carport, he called Harry Longbow and woke him up.
"Sorry, man," the other ranger said around a yawn. "Still haven't turned up squat. Not a thread connecting Otterman to you or anyone close to you. But I had to get some shut-eye. I called to let you know that I was taking a break, but got your voicemail."
"I had to leave my phone behind."
"Ah, hell. That doesn't sound good."
"Pat Connors turned up dead, and Otterman issued me a threat."
Harry grumbled.
"There goes my nap."
Crawford gave him the rundown.
"I got Georgia out of town. That was top priority."
"Where are you and the judge now?"
"She's on her way home."
"What about you?"
"If you don't know, you can't tell.
It will occur to Neil to ask if you've heard from me. I'm surprised he hasn't called you already. When he does, you can honestly tell him that you don't know where I am or what my plans are."
"I'll bring Sessions up to speed so he won't be taken unawares.
Thanks.
Maybe you ought to let that prick take you into custody. Jail's at least safe.
It's also sort of confining.
There's that.
How's the major taking it that I'm implicated in a murder?
Says it's about the deepest bullshit he's ever had to wade through. He's calling Neil Lester bad names, and he hasn't even met him yet. Any other time, Crawford would have laughed. But the situation was no laughing matter.
I'm attributing Chet, Rodriguez, and now Connor to Otterman, a body count of 3 just this week. I want this son of a bitch, Harry.
I'll get right back on it.
No. Finish your nap. Otterman is probably regrouping tonight, too. He had a busy day. The park video, the titty bar meeting.
The execution?
He didn't shoot the video and he didn't pop Connor. He doesn't do his own dirty work. He's got frickin' frack.
Who are they?
A pair of bodyguards. And then there are the Pat Connors.
Facilitators, too dumb to say no to him?
Too scared, maybe. You know what this is feeling like. Organized crime shit.
I'm liking this asshole less and less, Harry said.
Me too.
Keep your head down. Crawford gave him the number of his burner phone, then used it to make another call and impatiently counted the rings until Smitty's nasal twang instructed him to leave a message. Crawford said only,
"You know who this is. Call me back, or your shriveled pair are history."
He clicked off, checked the time, then pulled up the collar of his windbreaker and plunged into the rain. Chapter 28. When you told him to get out of your car, he didn't put up an argument. At first, Holly admitted in reply to Neil's question, but I told him I would take him absolutely no farther. He got out, I drove home. When she'd arrived, Neil Lester and Matt Nugent were sitting in an unmarked sedan at the end of her driveway. She drove around back and entered her house through the kitchen door, then met them at the front. As she ushered them inside, she said, "I spoke to Marilyn. She told me to expect you." She'd offered to make coffee, which they declined. They'd taken seats in the living room, and for the past 20 minutes, she had been recounting everything that had happened since getting the call from Crawford. "He didn't tell you what he was going to do." "Stay alive. Those were his words. For his daughter's sake, he wants very much to live." Having seen her safely away, he was much calmer than he'd been an hour earlier. When he called and asked for my help, he sounded desperate. Neil said,
"He was. He had just escaped from police custody."
"He told me that he drove himself to the courthouse and was willing to cooperate. He hadn't been handcuffed. He hadn't been arrested or read his rights." She paused and looked at the detectives expectantly. "Unless he was lying to me." "He wasn't." "We didn't do any of that," Nugent supplied, and when Neil shot him a withering look, he added, "which is why I figured he could be left alone to talk to his lawyer." Neil said, "If all he wanted to do was get his daughter out of harm's way, why did he fool Nugent and abandon his car? Why didn't he tell me about this phone call that caused him to take such drastic measures?" "He was afraid you wouldn't believe him. I think he was probably right." She paused to let that sink in. "He was afraid that every minute spent on sorting things out was another minute that his daughter's life was in danger." Defensively, Neil said,
"Nobody else heard this mysterious phone call, did they?"
"I was with him when it came in," Nugent said.
"But he told you it was the lawyer."
"Have you spoken with the attorney?" Holly asked. Ready with the answer, Nugent said, "Crawford had asked for a referral. Ben Knotts called him and got his voicemail. That call came in minutes after the one from the unknown." She looked at Neil. "He asked for an attorney. Doesn't that indicate that he had every intention of going through the questioning process, and would have, if not for that threatening call from Chuck Otterman?"
"No one has ascertained that it was Otterman," Neil argued. "The call from the unknown could have been a solicitation. He used it to trick Nugent."
Holly said, "If the call was a trick and the threat a fabrication, why would he have implored his in-laws to immediately leave town with his daughter? They will corroborate that's what's happened."
"Mr. Gilroy already has."
Nugent's statement left Neil no choice except to elaborate, although he did so grudgingly.
After dispatching a patrol car to their house and having it reported that nobody was at home, I called Joe Gilroy's cell number. I had it from interviewing him after the shooting.
He confirmed what I've told you?
To the letter. There's still no love lost between him and Crawford, but Crawford convinced him that the girl needed to be moved without delay.
I was similarly convinced, she said. Unlike you, I believe Mr. Ottoman is culpable.
That video seals it, Nugent agreed. Shut up, Matt, Neil snapped. It doesn't seal anything.
Holly didn't reveal that she knew the origin and content of the video to which Nugent had referred, but she looked at Neil and raised her eyebrows inquisitively. Stiff-lipped with resignation, he said,
Crawford has a video of Pat Connor in conversation with Chuck Ottoman. He claims it was shot at a local bar early this evening.
That's why Crawford left his cell phone behind, Nugent said. So we'd have that video.
He left his cell phone, so he couldn't use it to track him, Neil said with asperity.
Holly asked, Does Mr. Ottoman have an explanation for this conversation with the murder victim?
He's out of town. We're trying to locate him.
She looked around her living room. Forgive me, but you seem much more preoccupied with locating Ranger Hunt.
Because he skipped out on a homicide investigation, and even if he's cleared, he's dangerous and irresponsible. I shouldn't have to remind you of that. You've seen him in action.
Yes, I've seen him in action, saving lives and protecting others. Are you sure that your disapproval of his methods, compounded by your personal dislike, hasn't clouded your judgment?
Are you sure hormones haven't clouded yours?
Nugent made a choking sound.
Neil's glare stayed fixed on her. I think you keep defending him because you're just a little attracted to him, Judge Spencer.
Well, you're wrong, Sergeant Lester. I defend him because I believe he's right. And I'm not just a little attracted to him, I'm very attracted to him. The attraction is inconvenient. Until I recused myself from his custody case, it was unethical. It has the potential of causing me embarrassment and possibly costing me my job, making Crawford Hunt an unexpected complication in my life. But it does not make him a murderer. It does, however, make you a fool for pursuing him instead of the culprit. She stood up. Is there anything else?
Neil was still seething as she saw them out. She watched until they drove away. Only then did she close the front door and go around the room, turning off lamps.
After making sure the house was secure, she went into her bedroom, and, as she closed the door, leaned weakly into it and pressed her forehead against the cool wood. From behind her, one strong arm encircled her waist and firmly positioned her backside against an unquestionably aroused man. He gathered her hair in his fist and moved it aside so he could plant a hot kiss beneath her ear, whispering,
Well, Your Honor, guess you told him.
Chapter 29 Crawford slid his hands beneath her top and unhooked her bra. Reaching around to her front and up into the cups, he took her breasts into his palms. His fingertips played over her nipples. Holly's whimper of pleasure melded with a whine asking for more. He turned her to face him, rid her of top and bra by pulling them over her head together, and before her hair had settled back onto her shoulders, his mouth was fastened to her breast. She clasped his head between her hands as he drew on her with such fervor. The sensations were like sparks of electrical shock. She didn't want him to stop, but his wet clothing was an aggravation to both of them. He broke away from her to shed his windbreaker. He unbuttoned the first few buttons of his shirt, then, because that was costing precious time, he pulled it over his head. She didn't dare turn on a light and risk him being seen by her guards, but she wanted to know him. Placing her hands on his chest, she felt a dusting of hair and nuzzled it. His nipples were hard. She swept her tongue across one, causing him to hiss a swear word as he worked open the buttons of his fly. She reached into that widening wedge, feathered her fingers through the coarse hair, and closed her hand around him. His head dropped heavily onto her shoulder. As she explored, his panting breaths fell hot and moist on her skin. He was incredibly hard. The skin stretched tight along the shaft, the tip smooth and full to bursting. The pad of her thumb collected a drop of semen, spread it in deft circles until he puffed a profanity and moved her hand away. crossing his arms beneath her bottom. He lifted her and carried her to the bed. When she was lying on her back, he worked her jeans and underwear down her legs. Once they were off and out of his way, he got onto the bed, standing on his knees between her thighs, which he pushed back toward her chest. Then they both went completely still. For several moments, their heavy, irregular breathing was the only sound in the room, in the world. She sensed his movement before she felt his hands on the backs of her calves. He squeezed them, familiarizing himself with their shape. He caressed them up to the backs of her knees, where he outlined her kneecaps with his thumbs before covering them with his palms. Her breath hitched when his hands moved again, this time sliding up the insides of her thighs, slowly but purposefully opening them, opening her, for his descending shoulders, head, mouth. The heat of his mouth encompassed her. For precious moments he did nothing else, just that, just there. A gentle suction held her with motionless and incredible intimacy, until gradually he began to make love. Every brush of his lips, every whisk of his tongue, elicited a quickening of her entire body. Whenever his mouth withdrew to take a love bite from her inner thigh or to plant a kiss on her mound, her back bowed, her hips thrust upward in a restless, desperate yearning for him to find the one spot he had kissed around but had yet to touch. It wasn't until she groaned his name that he obliged her, but tantalizingly, applying his tongue so softly, so exquisitely, that her breaths evolved into moans and her body drew up tight. Attuned to her, he centered the caresses, concentrated them into ever-shrinking spirals, until the sensations painted onto her coalesced into a burst of pleasure so intense she couldn't contain it. He levered himself up and, with one strong thrust, he was inside her, appeasing her craving to be stretched, filled. He trapped her orgasmic cries inside a kiss and then let her drift down and rest while he sipped at her earlobes, her eyelids, her lips.
Her mouth opened beneath his, and the sweet kiss turned evocative.
His tongue coupled with her mouth as his hips engaged in an erotic rhythm. He moved in and out of her in breath-stealing juts and glides. Each stroke brought her closer to another orgasm, and when she was once again on the brink, he slid one hand under her bottom to hold her in place as he targeted several rapid thrusts that sent her over. Then he buried himself deep. His climax was shattering, long, intense. Eventually they recovered, but when he would have left her, she murmured a wordless complaint, and he resettled heavily atop her. Speaking low against her neck, he said,
"Where'd you learn to fuck like that?
Law school?"
"No, here, tonight."
She felt his smile against her neck. Levering himself up, he looked into her face.
"That night, after the shooting, and we were talking there in the hallway of police headquarters?"
She nodded.
"This is what I was thinking about,"
he said, and made a nudging motion.
"You weren't."
He gave a purely masculine and unrepentant shrug.
"You were so buttoned up in your dark suit and blue shirt, held together so tight. All the time I was trying to make conversation, I was wondering just how tight she is. Thinking about it was driving me crazy."
"You hated me."
"I did. Didn't stop me from wanting to fuck you."
He rubbed his lips across hers, which had parted in shock.
"I also thought it would never happen. Not in a million years."
"A million years? Or a few hours? I was easy."
He left her and, falling onto his back, he said,
"In no way has this been easy, Holly."
Raising his head, he looked down the length of his body.
"I can't even get naked first."
He remedied that by tugging off his boots and socks, then working off his wet jeans. Before tossing them to the floor, he removed a pistol from the holster clipped to the waistband.
"You told me you weren't armed."
"When I told you that, I wasn't. I borrowed this from Joe."
He set the pistol on the nightstand.
"Borrowed?"
"If he misses it, I'll beg forgiveness."
He lay down and drew her to him. Now, skin to skin for the first time, he passed his hand over her bottom and gave a grunt of satisfaction.
better.
Much. She plucked a few strands of his chest hair. I didn't know this was here.
Do you mind it?
In answer, she rubbed her cheek against it, then pressed a kiss on the warm skin underneath. How long had you been inside the house?
When Neil and Nugent left. About 10 minutes.
10 minutes?
He fondled her breast, asking thoughtfully,
Am I ever going to see these in the light?
They feel great.
What do they look like?
The plan was for you to wait until they'd gone before you came in.
I was getting soaked. Besides, I wanted to hear what they had to say.
He'd been surprised when she'd stopped the car and abruptly told him to get out. Then she'd outlined her plan, and, as she told the detectives, he had initially resisted the idea of her sheltering him overnight. But she had finally made him see reason. Every other place he could go would be watched. He couldn't just wander the streets in the rain, and he needed rest and refueling. The agreement had been reached about a mile away from her house. He'd had to go that distance on foot while she returned home and confronted the detectives.
I stopped on the way to make a couple of calls,
he told her now,
but got here and let myself in.
Remind me to relock that window.
I got here in time to hear that you're very attracted to me.
I told you I wouldn't lie to the police.
So it's true then?
True. She could tell by his grin that he liked hearing that. It was Marilyn who put me into mind of hiding in plain sight.
Please,
he groaned.
Don't mention her. I don't want to lose what I've got going here.
He captured her hand, sucked her thumb into his mouth, making it good and wet, then dragged it down and pressed it against the crown of his penis.
Work that wicked magic again.
He closed his eyes and exhaled deeply as she began a gentle rotating massage. In a whisper, she asked,
Who did you call?
His hand closed around her breast, but in a comfort-seeking way.
You said you stopped and made a couple of calls.
Harry,
he mumbled into the pillow.
What did he say?
That feels so good. Don't stop.
She smiled.
I doubt Harry said that. Who was the second call to?
Smitty. I've got to find him and kill him tomorrow.
Don't. You'd go to prison.
They wouldn't let you wear your boots in prison. And I like your boots.
They have character. They're well worn, not new and shiny. And you'd probably be made to wear your hair short in prison. It would be a shame to waste all this unruliness.
She ran her fingers through the thick strands.
The truth is, and I'm very into telling the truth, you know, there's nothing I dislike about you.
He responded with a soft snore. Chuck Otterman rarely stayed in the fishing shack overnight. It boasted even fewer creature comforts than his trailer at the man camp, although there was a double bed behind a plywood wall where he occasionally caught a few winks. He never slept more than 4 or 5 hours a night anyway. After dealing with the nightclub owner, he dozed, but he'd gotten up before dawn. While making coffee, he received a text notifying him that Neil Lester had called the office at the man camp and had impressed on the overseer left in charge that it was urgent he speak to him. Staring out into the heavy rain as he sipped his coffee, he thought that perhaps he should assuage the detective's anxiety. He used an untraceable cell phone to place the call.
Hello? Sergeant Lester? Chuck Otterman? Is it too early to call? I understand you've been trying to reach me.
Where are you, Mr. Otterman?
Hell if I know.
He lowered his voice as though he didn't want to be overheard.
Some colleagues over here in Louisiana invited me for a fishing weekend. I met up with them in Lake Charles, then we drove for hours. Far as I can tell, we're in the middle of nowhere. It's still dark and they're already on the water. Thank you for giving me an excuse to beg off.
What time did you meet them in Lake Charles yesterday?
I'm sorry?
Lester repeated the question.
Late. After dinner time. Why?
Apprentice police officer named Pat Connor was killed last night. He was quiet for a moment as though taking that in. Then he breathed a sigh.
I understand now why you've been trying to reach me. I met with the man right before I left town.
at a gentleman's club called Tickled Pink.
Oh, so you already knew. You must have questioned the owner. Smitty something. He's a cockroach. He scuttled over while I was there to ask if everything was to my liking. We want to question him, but so far we've been unable to find him.
Chuck Otterman chuckled.
That could be a problem.
Why do you say that?
Because, from what I understand, he tries to stay under the law's radar. He's probably as crooked as a dog's hind leg.
What were you doing in his club with Pat Connor?
I often meet with people there.
Lester cleared his throat. That doesn't seem like your kind of meeting place, Mr. Otterman.
The oil and gas industry has its opponents, from powerful politicians to crackpots. A goodly number of local businessmen and government officials support our exploration, but they don't want to advertise the fact. They refuse to meet with me in my office at the camp. They certainly don't invite me to theirs, so we meet at that seedy club.
I'm still not sure I understand.
It ensures discretion. Anyone in that place can't tell who he's seen there without giving himself away, can he?
The detective seemed to ponder that. It was a time before he said, Pat Connor was a cop, not a businessman.
He had heard, through the police grapevine, I suppose, about me seeing Crawford hunt with that man Rodriguez.
How did that relate to Pat Connor?
I don't know. He asked to speak with me privately. The only reason I agreed to the meeting was because he told me he'd been on duty in the courthouse on Monday. I thought maybe he had something to contribute or to ask me about that. But when I arrived at the club, he was in no condition to talk about anything. He was already drunk. He rambled. He sweated.
Sweated?
He wasn't in uniform. He was wearing a cowboy hat and kept taking it off to blot his forehead. He was anxious. Paranoid, actually. After about 10 minutes, I'd had it. He was wasting my time. I told him to get to the point or get lost. He got lost.
He left?
I thought he was too drunk to drive and offered to let one of my assistants take him home. He said no thanks. In hindsight, I should have insisted. He shouldn't have been behind the wheel. Was anybody else hurt?
He didn't crash his car, Mr. Otterman. He was murdered at home.
Jesus! When you said he'd been killed, I assumed...
Jesus. During his paranoid rambling, did he mention having any enemies?
No, but apparently he had at least one.
He let that resonate before continuing.
Did he have family?
He was a bachelor.
Lived alone.
Otterman didn't remark on that. He didn't ask if there had been any witnesses or if any evidence had been found at the scene, because he wasn't troubled about the crime being traced back to him. Men he used for jobs like this didn't make mistakes. If they did, it was their last one. Case in point, Pat Connor. After another stretch of silence, Lester said,
I understand you'll be back on Monday. Around noon.
You were one of the last known persons to talk to Connor. Would you come to headquarters so we can get an official statement?
Of course.
Then,
forgive me, Sergeant Lester, before you go, I must ask.
He rolled the coin across the backs of his fingers.
Do you have any reason to believe that this officer was another casualty of the courthouse incident? I mean, is it possible that he was silenced for something he knew or saw?
Stiffly, Lester replied, I can't discuss an ongoing investigation.
Right. Of course.
I'll see you on Monday, Mr. Otterman. Until then, what's a good number for me to call if I need to contact you?
Use the number at the camp. Someone there always knows how to reach me.
He hung up before the detective could say anything more. He caught the coin in his fist and banged it down on the table.
The final nail, he said around a smile.
It was now only a matter of time. Crawford came awake with Holly curled beside him, facing him, her face close to his on the pillow, her thigh snug between his. They still lay on top of the duvet, but at some point after he'd fallen asleep, she had pulled a throw over them. When she did, he had awoken, lifted her thigh over his hip, and slid into her. Being sheathed in her had brought a drowsy erection to a full one. Invitingly, she moved against him, took him deeper. He exerted just enough motion to create an erotic ebb and flow until they came together.
instead of fireworks, it had been as comforting as a warm bath. He hadn't even opened his eyes. Not a word had been spoken. But it had been intensely intimate, and, beyond feeling good sexually, he had felt an inner contentment that he'd missed during the years of sleeping in an empty bed and waking up alone. Now, gazing into Holly's face, looking incredibly peaceful and trustful in sleep, he felt a welling of tenderness for her, and with it, a primal surge of ownership. He wanted this woman. He wanted to claim her. He wanted to keep her. He couldn't. But he was here now. He pulled back the throw. The daylight limning the window shutters was new and fragile, but he could see well enough, and all the parts of her that he'd imagined or felt in the dark were prettier than he'd envisioned. Dipping his head to her breast, he gently sucked the delicate pink tip into his mouth. As he tested the texture of it with his tongue, she stirred, sighed his name, and rested her hand on his head.
I finally got to see you naked in the light.
And?
I wish I'd burned all your clothes while you were asleep.
She laughed softly. You're not so bad looking either. She leaned over him and kissed the center of his chest, his navel. Scooting down, she ran her hands over his thighs, and when she found the two scars on his calf, marking the entry and exit wounds of the bullet that had passed through, she kissed them and spoke softly of how grateful she was that it hadn't been worse. What if you had died that day? She asked, looking up at him with liquid green eyes. I'd have never met you. The emotional catch in her voice touched him deeply.
Come here.
He cupped her underarms and pulled her up over him until his mouth could take hers in a ravenous kiss. Gradually, mouths still eating at each other, he rolled her onto her back and stretched her arms above her head. He kissed his way down the undersides of both arms as his hand reshaped her breasts, then rode the contours of her ribcage down to her abdomen. Her breath stuttered against his lips when he trailed his fingers back and forth across the silky hollow between her hip bones, then through her pubic hair. It was blonde and soft, and beneath it, she was softer still. He sank his fingers into the fluid heat and returned his mouth to her breasts. Noticing a rosy abrasion, he asked,
Is that a whisker burn? You should have told me.
I didn't care.
Now?
I don't care.
I'll be gentle.
The merest flick of his tongue elicited a reaction.
Okay.
Yes, she gasped.
Again?
Yes. The carnal exploration of his fingers soon had her writhing sexily, and he knew she was close. He stretched above her and brought them eye to eye.
I want to watch you lose it.
He was stingy with the pressure of his thumb on the outside, drawing out the pleasure, holding off until she released a low keening, and then he curled his fingers forward inside her, creating a gentle squeeze between the two pressure points. She clamped her lower lip between her teeth. Her back arched as she raised her lips and ground against his hand. Into her ear he poured a litany of love words, sexy words, dirty words. Finally she coasted down, and her lazy eyes fluttered open. He laid a soft, tender kiss on her lips.
Beautiful.
You are. She reached up and pushed her fingers into his hair. And much sweeter than you let on.
Me? Sweet?
With your daughter? With me? She outlined the shape of his lips with her fingertip. You're not so tough.
Say things like that, you'll ruin my reputation.
I promise not to give you away if you'll kiss me again.
Thought you'd never ask.
He obliged her, sending his tongue deep into her mouth and savoring the taste he was coming to know, to need. When they pulled apart, she rocked against his erection. That's going to leave a bruise on my stomach.
We can't let that happen, it being such a pretty stomach and all. Any ideas?
She crooked her finger for him to lower his head, and then she whispered what she had in mind. He looked at her in shocked wonder.
Have you been spying on my wet dreams?
He focused on her mouth, on that full lower lip.
and when he placed the pad of his thumb in the center of it, she stroked it with her tongue. In a voice thick with arousal, he said,
"I need to shower first."
They showered together, and the soapy navigation they conducted over each other was inquisitive, extensive, and ended with him leaning against the back of the shower, one hand braced on the tile wall and the other on the glass door, hanging on for dear life, praying that he would survive the avid action of her mouth. She got out first, dried, and wrapped herself in the familiar robe. "I'll make breakfast." She left for the kitchen. He toweled off and moved around the bedroom, gathering his clothes and putting them on. They were uncomfortably damp, but they would have to do. He was slipping Joe's pistol into the holster when Holly returned, carrying a cup of coffee. "This will get you." She stopped when she saw that he was fully dressed, except for his windbreaker. "What are you doing?"
"I need to go before it gets any later."
"Go where?"
"I don't know yet."
"You don't have a car."
"That's a problem I've got to fix."
"Crawford," she exclaimed. He pulled on his windbreaker.
"What?"
"You can't just leave on foot."
"That's how I got here."
"What are you going to do?"
"I told you last night. Stay alive, if I can."
"Get Otterman before he gets you?"
"Or Georgia."
He hated even voicing the possibility, afraid of making it an omen.
"Because if Otterman wants to get to me, he'll eventually go after her, and the surest way to protect her is to remove him from the planet."
"You would kill him."
He just looked at her, then away, saying, "I can't do anything until I find him."
"When you do?"
"I'll have to wait and see."
With a solid thump, she set the cup of coffee on the dresser. "What are you going to do?" she repeated, enunciating.